Good morning, everyone, and thank you, John, for organizing this symposium today. And I've enjoyed being in the talks, and Randy and Martha did a nice job leading up into my subject area. So we're going to take a little bit of a detour and move further south and east from where we've been so far in Nebraska and Wisconsin. I'm located at the University of Kentucky, which is sort of the central heart of the relevance for this particular topic. So many of you know that right now in agriculture, kind of across the globe, there's been a renaissance and an embrace of trying to harness the power of the microbiome to improve agroecosystem function and resilience. And some of this is based on the fact that we think our agroecosystems prior to the industrial revolution and green revolution in particular were quite diverse systems. And so this schematic here is showing corn with all these little tiny dots on it being types of microbes in the seeds and the inflorescence on the leaves and the stalks, and then tons of them we know below ground. And we think these microbes help defend the plant against pathogens. They probably helped improve its efficiency to access fertilizer or nutrients turning over in the soil. And overall, they probably kept our nutrient cycles, as we like to call it, quite tight, right? So not a lot of losses and a lot of internal recycling. As we moved into kind of the industrial approach to agriculture, we know we replaced a lot of that with off-farm inputs, so fertilizer and pesticides, herbicides, et cetera, fungicides. And these have probably led to a drastic reduction in the plant microbiome of our crops. So the global hypothesis here is that if we can find ways to capture and increase the diversity and deployment of microbes in agroecosystems, we should be able to move out of our dependence on external inputs and try to improve the efficiency of these systems. The beauty of plant-microbe interactions is that they're hyper-diverse, they're all around us, they're widespread in nature, and they occur both above and below ground. And in the system I'll talk to you about today, we focus solely on the above ground piece here of leaf endophytes, or actually don't like the word leaf, but the ecologists use leaf endophytes. They're in pseudostem and they're above ground. And then, of course, there are many fungi that live below ground, such as mycorrhizae here. So again, the hypothesis is that using these types of organisms can improve the resilience and efficiency of agroecosystems. And I would argue that we have the best proof of being able to harness this type of good from C3 cool season pastures. And we've had 30 years of scientific research exploring particular plant microbiome interaction, and that's what I'll focus on today. So probably many of you here in the audience are familiar with this, but to make sure we don't leave anybody behind, I'm gonna give you a little bit of the background. The organisms I'm talking about are very unique and special, I think. They're claviceptaceous endophytes. They're members of the Ascomycete. They're thought to occur in 20 to 30% of grass species, and they're distributed worldwide, right? Within the claviceps, there are three sort of characterized types, and the fungi range from having sexual reproduction to clonal or asexual reproduction. The sexuals have horizontal transfer, meaning they're contagious and can often be pathogens on their plant host. The asexuals are vertically transmitted, which means they live their entire life cycle within their host. They require their host to be healthy and to help them move into new plant material through mother-daughter transmission, so infected mother to infected seeds. And the way they spread are reflected by that. Ascospores on the sexual and seed transmission on these asexuals. So the one I talk and deal solely with are these asymptomatic type 3s, okay? Because they are completely dependent on their host and are not contagious, this means that a seed, when planted into the soil of a plant host that carries these guys, it's either infected from the day it germinates and grows or not. And it'll stay that way pretty much its entire life, for its entire life. So, not contagious, born with it, and dies with it. Because of this very tight relationship, they've evolved together. It's widely considered to be a mutualism, good for both the host and the fungus, but we know that degree of mutualism varies quite a bit depending on the environmental context that the organisms are living in. These are very specific to C3 pooid grasses, okay, but within that group, they're quite prevalent. So many people find them when they go looking for them in these species, so both native and non-native. Okay, so the story on these guys, if you haven't heard it before, goes like this, right? We know a lot about them because many of these are now worldwide distributed pasture grasses, most of which originated from Eurasia at some point or another, but they're now kind of all across the globe except Antarctica. We believe that this grass fungal symbiosis has significant agricultural benefits. It increases plant growth many times. It definitely can be increase plant abiotic stress resistance, improve plant dominance and persistence, and it does some of this by deterring herbivory. These fungi have the ability to produce toxic compounds to both insects and mammals. So a lot of these effects are probably through the compounds, particularly the herbivory and potentially the dominance and persistence, but there may be a lot of other things that are going on that are not just alkaloid derived. So if you can think about this in an agronomic setting, it shouldn't make you a believer that this particular grass endophyte symbiosis has the potential to improve agroecosystem function, potentially reducing reliance on fertilizer. It's been that when the fungus is present, it can increase the uptake rate of soils nutrients in the soil. And for sure, it reduces pesticide requirements. And in places like New Zealand, where this type of fungus is very, or symbiosis is very dominant, the pest resistance is really a really important piece of how they deploy it there. Unfortunately, though, those toxic compounds that improve persistence and deter herbivory cause toxicosis problems in mammals that graze them. And so that's not ideal, and it's led to some of the well-known maladies of fescue toxicosis depicted on cattle here in the upper left and perennial ryegrass staggers on the sheep down on the right. So 30 years ago, 20 years ago, when they discovered that it was the fungus inside these grasses that was producing the compounds that were causing these problems, it led agronomists and fungal biologists to immediately try to address it. And the first way they tried to address it was simply to remove the fungus. We knew these were fungal products, so what happens if we remove it? You can remove the fungus, you spray with fungicide, and you can move the system to still grass dominated, endophyte free. The grasses can live without the fungus, they're just not as hardy. And that is problematic in a grazing system. So unfortunately, what we discovered is that removing the endophyte makes these things less persistent, and they're certainly less able to handle heavy grazing. And so that wasn't an ideal solution for pasture and forage agronomists throughout the world. That sent discovery, people to go back to the native range of where these organisms originated to try to find genetic strains of these fungi that lack the ability to produce those mammal toxic compounds, but still have the ability to produce those insect toxic compounds. And so many scientists from across the world went out on collection material basically around the Mediterranean Egypt region and a little bit further east. They collected in areas that looked stressful because we know the fungus is supposed to be important under times of stress. They brought those things back to their labs, grew the fungus out, and tested their capability of producing the alkaloids. And that has basically led to the discovery of a whole series, probably 20, 30 plus, even more if you go to an AgriSearch type library, of so-called novel endophytes. These are not genetically modified. These are naturally occurring strains of fungi that just simply have different capabilities to produce the alkaloids. So we'll call them novel endophytes here, though some people prefer other words like non-toxic, but that's not really true either because they're still toxic to the insects, so maybe just non-mammal toxic endophytes. So we have these things now. We can go back and insert them into endophyte-free cultivars. Because these packages are delivered through the seed, and the seed industry and forages is well established and used to distributing grass seed, these things are being deployed on the market. To two of which that I've shown you here. One of the first ones that came out on the market was Jessup Max-Q. Max-Q is the indicator of the endophyte. In this case, it's AR542. Right, Carolyn? Thank you. And so it came out in 2002. A more recent one here, Texoma Max-Q2, is developed at the Noble Research Institute. That Max-Q2 is an indicator that it's not the same genetic strain as Max-Q, right? This one is called AR584. And the AR stands for Ag Research. These were endophytes that are owned and discovered through Ag Research. So these days, I think we have, I would guess, 15 of the novel more, lower, she's pointing lower. So we'll go 10 to 15 novel, or what some people have called symbiotic modified organisms, these grass seed packages, on the market today. They're being deployed in pastures, certainly for research purposes, but we're trying to encourage producers to use them as we think they're fairly competitive and they don't have those animal toxicity issues. Some countries have been faster to develop and for farmers to adopt these than others. So my basic question is, what effects are these novel associations having? Are they causing differences in pasture ecosystems compared to what I'll refer to throughout the talk as the common toxic strain? Okay, because I'm trained as a grassland ecosystem ecologist, when I first came to Kentucky and discovered the world of this grass fungal endophytes, I got real interested in the effects other than the animals that might be going on here. This is a figure from Marina Omicini in Argentina that I've modified. These fungal endophytes exist solely in the above ground portions of the plant, where we know they produce toxic compounds that obviously have an effect on tissue quality and a direct effect on the herbivores. They can also improve biomass. These things might factor into giving us additional litter quality or litter quantity, potentially of an altered quality, which could affect soil microenvironmental conditions, the biota that decompose that material, and potentially soil carbon pools. I'm going to show you a little bit of data. The endophytes, although they're just above ground, have a whole amazing complexity of effects on the plant physiology. And there have been reports of alterations in root mass and exudates, which might also influence soil carbon pools. These things may in turn impact CO2, nitrous oxide, and other trace gas fluxes. So the basic hypothesis of my program is that endophytes may have unintended, potentially positive consequences for these pasture ecosystems, which they are regularly deployed for animal grazing purposes. All right, and we're going to look at some data that I hope convince you this is a possibility. When I first came to Kentucky, I thought soil carbon would be the easy way to start on this. At the time, I was naive and completely focused just on common toxic endophyte presence versus the endophyte-free, so not paying a lot of attention to those novel symbioses. I identified 9 locations throughout the southeast. The green line here is what's called the fescue belt, so this is where tough fescue is a dominant part of the vegetation. At each of these locations, they had compared, so side-by-side, common toxic endophyte-infected fescue with its endophyte-free counterpart. All right, and that meant we controlled for cultivar. So the same cultivar, either plus endophyte or minus endophyte. We went in, my first graduate student at Kentucky, and this is the only project I ever actually collected samples on, Randy. So like you, I'm presenting the work of a lot of other people today, but I did actually visit these sites and sample these back in the day. So these are just 0 to 10, so surface soil carbon pools that you see here from those sites. This is a paper that my postdoc, Javed Iqbal, published, who's in the back here. And what you can see is the endophyte infection is in the black bars, endophyte-free is in the white bars, and overall we had a significant endophyte effect, tended to promote soil carbon sequestration across these sites, though you can see it wasn't pronounced everywhere. The fact that we lacked a significant site by endophyte interaction, though, suggests that overall it tended to be positive. We knew these sites would have different levels of soil carbon because, as Randy just showed you, there are a lot of things that control soil carbon, and so we knew we had differences in soil texture, temperature, moisture, management, all these things. But the strength of this design is these stands were planted at the same time, managed the same way, And so we're really isolating the end-of-fight effect here. To put this into language that Randy just talked quite a bit about, if you average across all of these sites, you get a soil organic carbon accumulation of approximately 0.14 megagrams per hectare per year, with a range of zero at sites like Virginia to a range of 0.75 in places like Tennessee, the sites on the left, right? So to put these into context again with what Randy said, he was looking for a 40 gram of carbon per meter squared per year range. So you multiply these numbers by 100, you get the same units. And so it's not bad. 14 is a little lower than 40, but it's positive, and 75 is not bad at all. Again, to put these into context with other types of land uses that we think help us store carbon, if you take moldboard plow and move it into no-till or low-till conversion in ag fields, it says you get a range of about 0.2 to 0.6. And then taking ag fields out of agriculture and putting them into perennial grassland restoration can vary quite a bit, as Randy just showed, but this particular publication had from 0.2 to 1, right? So it's in the range. This isn't exactly snoozeville. We've done additional studies as follow-up to that. This particular one, we were looking at the genetic strain effects, so these novel associations. This is particulate organic carbon from the rhizosphere of, again, tall fescue that's either endophyte-free, infected with the common toxic strain, or MaxQ1 and MaxQ2. All right, and these, as you can see, we got a significant increase, so consistent with that regional data set of soil enhanced soil carbon underneath common toxic. And it looks like one, at least MaxQ2, may also have potential to move the system over the endophyte-free counterpart. I always get asked at these talks, yeah, but how are these effects created, right? People want to know what's driving the gain in carbon. The answer is probably a lot of things, okay, but I'm going to show you at least a couple of possibilities today. So in collaboration with the McNair Lab, and this is work from a PhD student, Jinji Guo here, we grew two strains of tall fescue. PDF is that Texoma. 97TF1 has just been released as Lacefield on the market. Both of these cultivars were either endophyte affected with either MaxQ1 or MaxQ2, or affected with the common toxic strain. And this is a heat map of 132 root exudate compounds. So these things were grown in little solution for 60 to 70 days, and then that solution was extracted, and we identified everything in it. And the heat map is showing you black are things that didn't vary much over the treatments here. Green varied some, and red varied a lot. And so what you can see is we're getting separation of the two cultivars. Whoops. Go back, sorry. Yep. So Texoma varies dramatically from Lacefield, but when you look within the two cultivars, the endophyte strain and endophyte presence is driving things too. For example, on the bottom line here, the common toxic endophyte infected version of Lacefield is clearly very different than everything above it, right? So one of the ways these effects may be pronounced is because the fungus in that above ground material is altering the physiology of the plant and what's coming out of the roots. These things we've also shown have an effect on the soil fungal communities. So this is again looking at tall fescue with those same treatments, and we're looking at bulk and rhizosphere fungi from a DNA perspective. And on this, you can see endophyte-free are the blue dots and are obviously different than everything that's endophyte-infected. Interestingly, in this case, the strains don't seem to separate. So just having epicloe appears to make your soil fungi different. It doesn't really necessarily matter what strain of epicloe you have. Well, these things you think, okay, so we've shown that they're having some below ground effects, and these appear to be manifesting in alterations to the soil carbon pool. I became very interested in whether it was also manifesting in trace gas fluxes back to the atmosphere. And so for that project, we wrote an international FACCE joint program initiative grant that involved my work at Kentucky, so tall fescue based, work in Finland that was meadow fescue based, so here endophyte infected versus common toxic, endophyte infected versus free. Spain, where we have individual space plants of red fescue, a circumpolar native fescue that associates with these epicloids. And then just last year, we were able to work in New Zealand with perennial ryegrass and looking at, if you know the system, AR1, presence and absence. A little bit of data on this. Here are the greenhouse gases from Jokioen in Finland. And so you can see methane production on the top. And again, this was just the common toxic strain present or absence. When you sum across all those points, you actually can see that endophyte-infected meadow fescue is a sink for methane in the system, whereas endophyte-free is a source. If we move into carbon dioxide, endophyte-infected meadow fescue is producing less CO2 back to the atmosphere than endophyte-free, and it's producing less nitrous oxide emissions than endophyte-free. Looking at some data that Javed generated from Kentucky, we can see that we had somewhat similar results, though in our case, our most dramatic effect came between the two novels. MAX-Q2 doing a much better job at reducing CO2 and nitrous oxide fluxes compared to its MAX-Q counterpart. New Zealand, though, the story was a shorter-term study, and we're not seeing dramatic impacts of AR1 presence within the perennial ryegrass system. So to conclude here, obviously fungal endophytes and grasses have been used for decades now to try to improve the sustainability of grazing lands, primarily by focusing on improving animal performance and forage production and persistence. But my whole effort here today is to try to convince you that there are other potential benefits of deploying this technology in these systems. I think there's a chance that they're going to sequester carbon for us and potentially reduce greenhouse gas fluxes back to the atmosphere. The trick is we need to better understand when this is going to happen, where it's going to happen, and how it's happened so that we can try to manage for that. And with that, I'll thank all the people who do this work and my funding sources, and I'm happy to take a question.